Well, good evening. Welcome, everyone, to the 529 Emergency Preparedness Discussion Net, courtesy of the WA7ABU 529 repeater. Excuse me. This is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. My name's Brett, and I'm net control for today, 2020. This net meets each Tuesday evening from 7 to 8 p.m. local time on 145.29 megahertz. Before I continue, can I get a quick signal check? I get a little bit of noise feedback there. Make sure you're hearing me.
N0NNO, you're solid. N0NNO.
Okay, thanks, Fred. Let me continue then. Yeah, just I'm getting our, you know, some noise that's breaking through the squelch there in between. Anyway, this is designated emergency frequency, so we'll break if any real emergency occurs. Our alternate frequency is 145.19 with a tone of 100. We appreciate those who stand by and allow us to have a clear frequency for the next hour as we discuss emergency preparedness with our timely emphasis on the COVID-19 pandemic, and tonight we'll probably talk about the vaccinations that are happening and the Pfizer vaccine. But we can talk about other stuff. If you have other topics you'd like to talk about, we'll do that too. Let's see. Reminder, we're not trying to do a sort of a political thing here, you know, and decisions made by different countries versus our countries, you know, things like that. Let's just try to focus on things that you've read that are facts or that you'd like to talk about or maybe have questions about. I'll do my best to, you know, answer if I know. I'm not afraid to tell you I don't know something. I won't make anything up. We try to stick to the truth here. I try to look up the actual references for things rather than try to look at the newspaper reports on things, because sometimes, you know, that's a way of getting kind of confused. So you get some sensational information. And if you have found something like that that seems, you know, unusual to you, and you want to discuss it, you know, critically, you know, that could be a topic too. We could look it up and try to prove or disprove whatever the wild claim is. But, you know, I don't want it to be a forum for things where, you know, we talk about, you know, what ifs and you know, decision making. But we can talk a little bit about what I know about the obviously logic in terms of why they decided to do a particular group or what the advantages or disadvantages be, even though that we may have no say in that. Make it a drip. Okay, so let's, again, you're all amateur operators, welcome to participate. We'll start with a check in the stations that would like to participate or maybe just listen in on the discussion. Let's see. Let's start first. When you check in, let's use your call sign and use phonetics, please. And you also give me your name and your location, and I'll recognize you. Again, directed net. Let's start first with any Echolink check-ins. If we have any Echolink users, come out. Okay, I'm not hearing anybody on Echolink. Okay, general check-ins for the emergency preparedness net.
Hi, Brett. Whiskey 7, Sierra Hotel, Mike, Steve, Albany.
Good evening. This is Kilo Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango, Art and Canby.
Hello, Brett. Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform. I just have to listen out.
Hey, Brett, Kilo, Foxtrot, 7, Bravo, Uniform, Victor, Walton, Woodburn.
Good evening, everyone. Kilo, Alpha, 7, Juliet, Lima, Oscar, Jeff in Albany.
Okay, there's a good start. Let's pause there for a minute. Working backwards, that was Jeff, Kilo Alpha 7, Juliet Lima Oscar. before that was Walt. Kilo Foxtrot 7, Bravo Uniform Victor. Dan was in there, WA7ABU, or Whiskey Alpha 7, Alpha Bravo Uniform. Art was in there, Kilo 7, Alpha Romeo Tango. Thank you for checking in. Anybody else?
Kilo Golf 7, Papa Echo Papa, Mark in Newburgh.
November 0, November, November Oscar, Fred Lafayette.
Okay, that was Mark, Kilo Golf 7, Papa Echo Papa. Then Fred, November 0, November, November Oscar. Welcome to you. Anybody else?
Whiskey 7, Sierra Hotel Mike, Steve Albany.
Okay, there's Steve, Whiskey 7, Sierra Hotel Mike. Very good. Anybody else for emergency preparedness net?
Echo 7, Oscar Lima, Uniform Paul, UC Marin County, Aries Group, Northeast Salem.
Okay, welcome to Paul there, Kilo Echo 7, Oscar Lima, Uniform. Okay, still taking check-ins. We only have about 9 of us here, so let's keep going here. This is the emergency preparedness net. Let's take some more check-ins.
Kilo Juliet 7, Echo Charlie X-ray, Blade, Salem.
There's Blaine, Kilo Juliet 7, Echo Charlie X-ray. All right, this is Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo. We're taking check-ins for the emergency preparedness net. Okay, let's... Well, I guess we can pause here for any news and announcements for the net. Does anybody have any announcements? Okay, well, let's see. One thing I want to announce, of course, all our things that we have, different nets and what have you, what, Tessie might have realized that the YouthNet is at now 5:30 on Tuesdays, right before this one. And we have our HeritageNet that is fairly new. That's on Monday nights at 7. It seems like we have a net almost every night. You know, the Wednesdays, the Slow Scan TV net, these are all at 7 o'clock. But the Slow Scan happens at 8 o'clock, or around 8:30 is when they start. They test at 8, and then they start sending pictures soon after that, around 8:30. Thursday night is the Mesh Network discussion net. And one of the things that we wanted to mention is that there seems to be an interest in having a net on the topic of fusion, using the fusion system. So our 444.950 repeater is connected to Wires X using the Yaesu Fusion CD4 FM radios. And there's a desire to have a net, at least if it might just start out being a social net, but it also could be a tech net or, you know, information sharing or what have you. One of the advantages, this will be at 7 o'clock on Friday, so you can check into Dan's repeater, but one of the keys to the net is it will be held in a particular room. I have these fusion rooms for those of you who have Yaesu radios. You're familiar with this, that room concept is that you get on a frequency and then you can move to a if you're on the wire's X system, you can move to a different location that's shared by other users. And so they're using a room called the Northeast Oregon Room, so November Echo-Oregon, and the gathering place for this net. So it'll be 7 o'clock on Friday in the Northeast Oregon Room, so you can get there from any fusion system. Just get into that room. So, are there any questions on that? Okay, I'm not hearing any questions on that one. Okay, let's see. I think we'll have to see how the radio stuff goes. I have heard that there is a solar flare that is supposed to be coming, and our space weather may not be as good as it has been in terms of we might get some more noise from a coronal mass ejection. So let's keep an eye on our space weather. That's probably starting tomorrow and the next day. That's all I have for news. Does anybody else have anything else that they'd like to bring up? Okay, well, moving on, let's get a few more check-ins for our emergency preparedness discussion now tonight. Again, we'll probably start again with our COVID-19 report and move on to talking a little bit about the FDA paper, which was released today, evaluating the safety and effectiveness of the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine, which I guess the big news outside of it is that Great Britain began vaccinations today on their population, having given emergency authorization to the COVID vaccine developed by Pfizer and BioNTech. And we'll talk about again what that vaccine is. But the first woman that got it, they said, was this 90-year-old lady. And the second person that got it was an 81-year-old man named William Shakespeare. No relation. Thought there were a lot of jokes on the BBC newspaper about it was much ado about nothing and things like that. They have a strange sense of humor there in Great Britain. So anyway, that started today, so they authorized it before we did, and they're starting to vaccinate away, so we'll see what happens. All right, let's see. Any other check-ins for Annette tonight? Okay, welcome, Richard Whiskey Zero, Echo Delta Foxtrot. Yeah, Richard got surprised by a big scientific paper in the mail today, so I wanted him to look at it. I don't know if you got a chance to see the document that I emailed you there. Pretty long document. I just actually kind of just got through it. It's a lot of numbers and tables of data. Did you get to see the FDA report there? Yeah, you can see that, Richard's a good man with numbers and things like that. That just going over these numbers, there is a certain trust factor that you have to have in someone gives you their data. If you did see something that stands out, I'll please bring it up, and I'll try again to repeat it if you're going ahead and recording this again tonight so that you're comments or questions get on there. Anyway, I guess we can get started with our, let's see, one more chance at any other check-ins here. Okay, so again, situational awareness. We are watching what's the important thing to watch. Yes, our cases are still growing in Oregon. That is the most important thing to us, but and we've talked before about you know, our hospitalization is probably for you know, the general public. Hospitalization is the resource that we're trying to maintain in the face of this pandemic. You know, there will be people who will, you know, get the virus and they won't have to go to the hospital, but there's a small number of those people. It's actually, you know, a significant number, but it is enough significant in the sense that it's enough to start filling the hospitals. Okay, so as case numbers grow, the numbers in the hospital grow. And what we've been seeing, again, as I mentioned before, you know, beginning October 30th, we had like 179 people in the hospital and 52 in the ICU and 20 on ventilators, people who had confirmed coronavirus, right? We're looking at right now numbers of 553 people in the hospital, 127 in the ICU, 58 on ventilators. Now, that number seems to have steadied a little bit since I talked to you guys last week, on December 2nd. So it dropped a little bit, but it's kind of still hovering in that 550 range. The number in the ICU has gone up a little bit, from 115 to 127. So, again, what? So this resource, we talked about it, like, we don't want to run out of hospital beds. We have a certain number of beds that are available, right? And it is interesting that, the state of California, just this last weekend, on Sunday night, actually, at midnight, they imposed some more severe restrictions on closures and movement and stay-at-home orders and things like that. And what they based that on is on the ICU bed capacity, the reserve capacity of ICU beds in California. So on a statewide level, that's what they're looking at. So let's talk about that a little bit, see if that makes sense to you. So if they, you know, what they wanted, they want to reserve 15% of the ICU beds. As, again, you know, if you have 85% of the people in there are in the ICUs that are suspected COVID cases, if you're having a 15% for other people that get other illnesses that are non-COVID related, motor vehicle accidents, heart attacks, strokes, you name it, you know, people end up in the ICU for a variety of reasons. You know, if we're all full of COVID, then people's healthcare is going to suffer in general, and that's what we're trying to avoid, right? So, but those are the people who are, you know, the most severe, you know, severely ill with this, and it's always been a lower number than the total hospitalizations. But their rule was that if you don't have 15% reserve capacity in your beds or in your ICU, then the community gets a lockdown order. So that's what's happening, and it's in California. It's affected in Los Angeles County and in Fresno County. Those are the places that have a lower than that amount of capacity. So they are under an order, a lockdown order. They're much more severe than it was. You know, restaurants are closed, except for takeout, and you know, many people are encouraged to stay home and no travel and what have you. So, but it's based on hospital capacity. So, any comments on or questions about that?
KE7PYM. Well, at least I can say at least the governor's very concerned about California then.
Yep. Okay, let's see. Let me make sure I got your call because you said it didn't say it so nicely. Was it PYN or like Papa Yankee November, or could you say it again phonetically? Sorry.
Sorry about that. I swallowed the microphone. Kilo Echo 7, Papa Yankee Mike, and it's Romeo Ontario Yankee. Good evening.
Okay, I got you there, Roy. Sorry. Kilo Echo 7, Papa Yankee Mike. It's the M that I thought you said N, but we got close, I think, but yeah. it was good experience to be net control, because that way you can hear lots of call signs, and some of them are Y, you know, M's and N's and E's and Z's and, you know, C's and things like that. You know how it goes. So we use those phonetics, and then we have less confusion in your net control person. Okay. So, yes, you know, so right now, again, we have this issue that different states have different criteria for what they do. And it's interesting because, you know, up until now, we're hearing you mostly about, well, geez, you know, if the cases, you know, the percentage of people who are testing positive and things like that. But, you know, I think, in my opinion, the good thing is that if you start looking at the thing I've been talking about, which is what do we need to worry about, we need to worry about, yes, that we see the cases are going up. That happens, right? But what does it mean in terms of severity, is, you know, if, in terms of our limited resources? So, you know, we've got to plan so that we can take care of these people. We need to have the staff, and we need to have the space, and we need to have the stuff, you know, the PPE and all that. And, you know, you can plan for, you know, if everybody around the country starts having the same problem, then you get shortages of those things. And so, yes, it would be really nice if we could just get those numbers back down and be flat again. But unfortunately, they are lagging. You know, remember, hospitalization comes 2 weeks after infection for most people, and then, you know, people are going to have a severe thing with death. That death rate might go up again after another couple weeks. But the death rate so far, again, that I guess if you look at it from, I don't know if people have learned about triage. When we take, you know, there's like the CERT training class, you learn about triage, and you talk about, you know, people that you can do something with, and you divide them in a disaster, into a red group, a yellow group, and a black group, okay? So red people are people you can do something about if you, you know, but they need immediate attention. They take the most resources. They need to be transported quickly, et cetera. Yellow, I guess there's also a green in there. Green, you know, people. Green is people that might be injured or sick, but they can kind of take care of themselves for a while, okay? Or they don't need their attention. Yellow are people in between. They can wait a while, and they've got, you know, they've got a problem, but you know, you need to deal with it, but you don't have to deal with it until you've dealt with the red people. So that's a triage thing. Triage is always something that happens in hospitals. Okay, they have to decide when people are coming in waves, who do you going to treat first, you know. So, and they want to put their resources toward the people that they can do the most for. So obviously when you get somebody like on a ventilator that's kind of stuck, they're taking a lot of resources and they're taking a, you know, an ICU bed probably, and, you know, that they're going to stay there for a while, right? So that's holding the space that could be used by somebody who is acutely ill that might just need to be seen, you know, and treated. So let me get a drip here. You know, I asked Dr. Sund about this. She said, well, I would rather them base it on the total hospital beds, not the ICU beds necessarily. We seem to actually have plenty of ventilators. We seem to be able to make ventilators. We got those out there and in people's hands. There are other countries who are, you know, messing up. I was reading about one hospital that ran out of oxygen. They didn't have enough oxygen for their general patient use. And, you know, a lot of people get oxygen that end up in the hospital with COVID. So, if you ran out of oxygen, you're kind of in trouble there. So, anyway, those are all resources that, so not everybody, like the people might be on oxygen and not be in the ICU. Beyond oxygen, most rooms can have oxygen, right? So it affects all the healthcare. So she said it would be nicer to look more at the total number of hospital beds and maybe set that as a criterion. But that's the one that affects our healthcare. Are there any comments or more check-ins, or before we move on to talking about vaccines and things? This is Kilo Golf 7 Golf Delta Bravo. I'm going to look up the RT number for us real quick. and you can look at one of these, in your favorite site. You know, it's kind of like, we've dropped down a little bit here. That's good. Bergen has dropped back on our R value now. This week they've estimated a different R value. We are no longer the worst in the nation. That's good. Our R value is estimated at 1.09. We are behind. California is the highest at 1.21. Georgia, New York, New Hampshire, Delaware. They're all, it looks like there's only, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11 states who are below our values of 1. So those are growing numbers of, it's an estimate, an epidemiology estimate of the growth of the virus, the spread of the virus. Okay, so anyway, we're down to probably about 15th or 16th down. No longer the worst in the country. That's good. Okay. So keeping, you know, an eye on our own numbers, that's the most important for us. People are still dying, and we still have a lot of cases. You know, if you want to look at, worry about the cases again, our case count is 1,300, about 1,341. Announced on Monday cases. Again, that's a lot more than it was at the, we had at the beginning, retrospectively back, we started again on October 30th, 596 cases. So, still a lot more. And that trend seems to be going up and not flattening out. We really want to flatten out the trend, and we'll talk about that a little bit more later about the vaccines. That makes our vaccines work better if we can get this growth under control. Okay, so news, big news of the day. All right, so going on to the big news of the day here. Yes, first vaccines given of the emergency use authorization in Great Britain. Okay, and the other thing is, so they basically, Great Britain is going to go ahead and start their injections. All right, so that's great. They're going to get a couple weeks ahead of us probably before we start giving this stuff out. Now, let's talk a little bit, it'll be the same dosage criteria. Let's talk about this particular vaccine, what it is and how it's dosed, because I learned this by reading about the FDA documents. The second thing that happened was they released the report. The FDA is going to meet on Thursday and decide whether to do the make an argument for emergency use authorization for this particular vaccine. And what I learned by reading their report is what that really means. Why, you know, how can they? What are they looking for? What are they out of the manufacturer when they let them do an emergency use versus you know, complete licensed vaccine? Okay. So that's kind of important for us to understand, just that it's why, and partly why it's so slow normally to get vaccines going. Okay, you get a drip. Okay, so FDA released this great document, and it is 49 pages, 50 pages long. It's one of several documents that's available on the FDA review. Now, the difference, as I read, between Great Britain and the United States in terms of their emergency use is that Great Britain takes the word of the manufacturer that they've done their trial and that their data shows it's safe and effective, and they say, okay, go ahead, right? So what are the criterion that we do? That's the difference. So our FDA gets the raw data, and they do their analysis, and the manufacturer does their analysis, and they summarize it in a big bunch of tables, of which it's a very, very long technical document. Lots and lots of numbers, which I won't bore you entirely with unless you have some specific thing I could look up for you. But let's talk about, there's also background information about how severe this is, you know, and how many, you know, this is the kind of stuff that you know, the framework for what we're dealing with here. So basically start out saying that, yes, it's a really bad situation. We've had over 260,000 deaths, over 13 million cases in the United States alone. And, you know, so what they, basically what happened is that they're in March, they actually said, all right, we're going to let the FDA start working on vaccines and allowing emergency use authorizations of any vaccines that come up. And then at the time, they came up with some criterion about what would you need to do to get authorized. It's called an EUA, or emergency use authorization. Okay, and so this is the basic idea. So, and they said basically because of this pandemic falls under what they call a chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear agent, CBRN, defined in the March 27th declaration by the Secretary of Human Services, that this can cause a serious or life-threatening disease or condition. Okay, so this agent, SARS-CoV-2, so it meets that criterion that it causes a serious or life-threatening condition. And then based on a totality of scientific evidence, if there is any reason to believe that a product may be effective to prevent, diagnose, or treat such life, serious or life-threatening disease that can be caused by SARS-CoV-2, or it mitigates a serious or life-threatening disease, then that's the first criterion. Can it be effective in preventing, diagnosing, or treating such a disease? Okay. The third is that the benefits outweigh the known and potential risks of the product. And finally, there is no adequate approved alternative to the product. Okay. Nothing already pre-approved, right? So nothing's approved, and it's all novel, so, you know, they're going to do emergency use authorizations. Now, the interesting thing that I read in here is that they also said that if you wanted to get a vaccine, you needed to have a placebo-controlled efficacy trial of at least 50% effective in order to be considered for this. Okay, now the other thing is that they said that, this is important, is that since they combined these different phases of trials, going to phase 2 and 3, phase 1 is a small number of people just to prove dosing and safety, and then phase 2 normally happens with the next larger group of people, 3 adds a huger group of people. Okay, they combine 2 and 3, and this particular drug, we'll talk about those, the data is actually given to almost 43,000 people around the world, and we'll talk about that in a second, okay? But in order to do it, they have to follow at least 2 months behind following the full vaccine regimen. In this case, it is a two-shot vaccine, okay? You get two vaccines injected into the muscle, at 21 days apart. That's how it's given. You get 30 micrograms of the stuff that they've made. And the stuff is basically something called an mRNA vaccine. The Pfizer one is made from a portion of the spike protein on the SARS-CoV-2 virus. And it is encased in a lipid carrier. It's called nanolipid. And they give a bunch of chemicals that it's made of. Okay, so it's a little kind of like a little fatty capsule that contains this bit of messenger RNA, which is synthesized in the lab. Okay, they supply it frozen in a very, very cold freezer in 5 dose vials. And then you dilute it with just 5 injections, so 0.3 ml per dose. After dilution, the vials must be kept to be at basically refrigerated temperature and used within 6 hours. Okay? Now, so that's how the actual stuff looks. And then they gave it to a whole bunch of people. they settled on a 30 microgram dose, and that they divided their people up into, you know, people who got just the saline and people who got the actual vaccine, and there was 50-50, you know, split up randomly into two different groups. Now, it included the United States, Argentina, Brazil, Germany, South Africa, and Turkey in the study, okay? And initial studies were just with a small group, but it did include 18 through 85 years of age. So it was 18 years through 85. It actually had equal numbers in the 65 through 85 year age group in the first trial, the first phase. It was actually, they really did focus on the higher at-risk group in the first phase. Okay, so that was one of the questions that came out last week, is did they really check any old guys with this? And they did, okay? Now, the next thing that they were doing with it and is that they basically gave us our results. And there's essentially, you can go through this if you want, but let's see, the bulk of the participants came from the United States, but, the largest group came from the United States, but it wasn't out of the entire group. It wasn't a United States study, so they included people from other countries, right? So, in terms of we had 6,653 United participants total. Okay, the rest of the people came from the 43,000 came from the rest of the world. Okay. They tried to get a variety of people. Again, nobody was really included under the age of 18, and then they did break them up in different age groups, and they did have a group which they said over 65, and that still represented a fair percentage of people. I was going to try to give you that number here real quick. I tried to highlight some of these things. This is like a 50-page document, so bear with me here a little bit. It was at least like 20% of the people were over the age of 65. There it is. I got it. 26. Sorry. So a little bit of demographics. Yeah, 49% female, 81%, almost 82% white, almost 10% African American, 4% Asian, and 3% from other racial groups. 26% were Hispanic Latino. There it is. 21.4% were over 65 years of age, and they had median age of 51 years. And most common comorbidities that people had were obesity, diabetes, and pulmonary disease. Most of the 35% were obese. Geographically, it says 76% were from the United States, 15% from Argentina, 6% from Brazil, and 2% from South Africa. It doesn't all add up to what I was telling you before, but this is why you read these papers. But okay, so it did, you know, cover a lot of people. There weren't a lot of like Native Americans in the group. There weren't a lot of Asians, included in this. All right. But then they gave these people the vaccine, and they found that basically, in all cases, there always was a much greater number of people who got COVID in the non-vaccinated group, the placebo group, than got the vaccine. Okay. It's been reported that they started to see some effectiveness after 10 days after the first dose. Again, there's two doses, 21 days apart. They start looking at they look at side effects for 7 days after you get the dose, and they did some reports on that. And then they follow up with, how many people showed COVID-like symptoms, any kind of respiratory symptoms. And anybody that had that after the 7 days got the nose swab PCR test, and they looked at whether or not they really had COVID or not. Now, a couple things that are missing from this. Let me just stop here. They didn't, you know, test everybody that got the vaccine to see, you know, for COVID, you know, so only people that reported symptoms, all right? So there could be asymptomatic people that were not reported, all right? They actually said that there were people who had previously had COVID in both groups. Okay, they did take track of that, but again, they didn't fall out that there was any difference in the, again, they were only looking for people who showed symptoms, so maybe those people were immune, we don't know. But we represented about 3% of the participants who reported having COVID before. But overwhelmingly, large number of people, it seems effective in all groups, and especially effective after the second dose, all right? After 21 days. So that's good news. So it seems there really are huge differences among the groups in terms of the percentages seen in all age groups. Okay, and then also does anybody have any comments or want to check in there? We're just talking about the effectiveness or what they call the efficacy at this point. We won't know the true effectiveness until the trials are over. But let's stop here for any comments or any more check-ins. Okay, I hope you haven't gone to sleep and you're still absorbing all this stuff. Because basically, yeah, I'm going over just the data. And the good thing is that they have given us the data finally, all right? Up until this point, in terms of publication, you know, the results of the first phase trial were published in the New England Journal of Medicine. And I looked at that article, and it all looks pretty good. And that was like on the 190 people, not even that many, 90-something people. Like 45 in each group. So it wasn't a large number of people in phase one. They published those results, and again, they were pretty good, you know, good differences in effectiveness, really no signs of problems with it, no bad adverse events, okay? So that allowed them to proceed on with a large group of people. Now, here's an interesting thing, though. In order to get an emergency use authorization, you may not realize this, but the government says that the people, even if we give the authorization, they authorize it this week, the study continues. Okay, so if you're in that study, you need to continue taking, whether you were in the placebo group or not, you need to be followed up still for up to 6 months. Okay, so after you started the study, so you have to finish the clinical trial. All right, and they do say that they will consider people, you know, if they really, actually the drug company would like to give everybody the vaccine now that they think it's working, you know, and that. But this is one of those things where it may not be obvious, but it might be polarizing in your opinion as to whether you should, once you find out that something works as well as it does, why not give it to the placebo group? Does anyone have any comment about that? Like, why don't they just say, oh, well, you know, if you're going to approve this thing now for emergency use, why don't we just, you know, everybody that, all the other people that you have signed up there, the other 18,000 people, why don't they get the vaccine? Any comments or questions about that? Yeah, go ahead, Richard, and I'll repeat the question for the recording. Okay, well, so it would be a different kind of data. What they want to collect is what's, you know, the side effect data, the adverse event data on people. So I understand it right, they don't even, in Great Britain they were talking about, they don't even record that you get a card, like a reminder card, come back for your next vaccine, but they're not going to even identify your name on the card or anything. They're not, you know, going to probably make, you know, like, oh, you've had a vaccine, so therefore you've got this, you know, whatever, on your record that, you know, you can carry the card around or something like that. But what we do need to know, this is based on the second part is the safety part, okay? So now we're addressing that evaluation. So you have to complete the safety evaluation. That's the part that we have not completed yet. You know, right now we'd like everybody to be, to follow up. The safety plan was to follow everyone for 2 years, okay? So all the subjects will be followed up to 2 years after the, 6 months after all subjects looking for serious adverse effects, looking for, they're going to basically look for adverse effects. That's the side effects, and they divide them into mild. Let me start with the different sets so you'll hear these numbers. The first thing they do is they look at 7 days after the dose, okay? And that period they call reactogenicity, all right? And the plan was that they needed to look at least 6,000 people and at least 500 in each country for how well they, you know, or how poorly they reacted to that first dose and the second dose. And what they found, let me just tell you real quick, is that there is reactivity in all the groups. You can get reactivity, you know, in the saline group, okay? But the side effects are what you normally see from vaccinations, that are muscle injection, pain at the injection site, you know, swelling, redness, that kind of thing. Then there are some flu-like symptoms that you get. All those happen. They want to report those in the 7 days. If you're in the study, right? They did find out that after the second dose, that reaction was more severe than it was the first time. More pain. So unfortunately, you're going to get the side effects again, harder after the second dose. And that has to do with how our body reacts to. That means it's working, right? We really are attacking this stuff. But after the second dose. 7 days after that, then, you know, we just follow up for 1 month or 6 months or 2 years following that second dose to see if there's any non-serious effects. That's really only if that's just 6 months normally. We want to make sure that everybody but you still have to have a control group, right? That's the problem, is you need to compare the percentage of these people that are having problems with that control group. Because they got they went through the same process, right? So again, that takes time, and that's why they actually can't withdraw. You mentioned the term. Why don't we unblind them right away as soon as they get authorized? Well, they would like to do that, but they still need to maintain people for at least 2 months in the control group before they get the vaccine, and they would prefer to keep them in the full, so that's been 6 months in the full trial to see if there's anything happens. But that is a little bit of the problem. So volunteering, you know, to be part of the study is that you need to complete the study before you would ever get the vaccine. They're not going to give it because we won't be able to tell, you know, whether the effects, we won't be able to do the statistics on the tests and see just how bad are the side effects. But right now, the side effects at this point in time are not bad enough to warrant, denying this vaccine. It looks like it's safe and effective. Okay, so anyway, this is a part of the reason that it normally takes a long time to get vaccines sent, because we would normally go through one, two phase of the entire trial before they could get an authorization for this thing. And then we'd wait for all those results to come back in. Now, as a result of the, you know, there were a couple of strange ones that they saw. And there were four cases of what's called Bell's palsy in the group, and we need to find out whether the Bell's palsy cases are more, you know, more than the regular population, all right? And so there will be, as part of the authorization, you know, they'll be looking for certain adverse effects. So they'll be like, hey, watch out for Bell's palsy, basically, in anybody that gets the vaccine, to see if that is something that will appear later on. So this is the real issue, that why we want to wait, you know, to get more data before we really prove its safety. But it does look like it's effective. Now, the next part we don't know is we don't know how long it's going to be effective for, and that's, again, that comes with time. So, but that doesn't mean that we can't start with this and based on the criteria that it is effective and it's safe, and there's nothing else that we can do with it right now. It's better to get this thing started now than later, okay? So that's why Britain has gone ahead and started. Yeah, Richard, go ahead. Yeah, again, the efficacy thing, they show that data in here in this big document. You'll see that they break the table up into, you know, the percentages of, they look at the percentage of people who get the COVID in both groups after the first dose, and then again after the second dose, usually after 7 days of waiting period, because we don't want to confuse the flu-like symptoms with COVID. So any symptoms that persist beyond the 7 days, they look at that. And that's, yes, they showed efficacy, which is in the 50s after first dose, and they showed 95% average after the second dose. So that's what they call the, it seems like that is the efficacy in general. So that's really good. So overall efficacy, they had 8 people. That's basically after the, you know, dose 2, 8 people in the vaccine group got COVID, and 162 people in the placebo group got COVID. That's 95%. And so that's good. And but, you know, again, that's not a lot of cases out of that number of people, and, you know, over time, you know, probably more people in the placebo group will get continue to get COVID, right? Because they don't have that number will probably grow. The question is, it also looks at the severity, and it looks like that the severity is was less. There are fewer people in the, they look at how bad of COVID you got, and that's another thing, is whether you got a mild, you know, severe, or, you know, cases. They broke in the people, that group that got COVID, into how bad was it, and it seems like there are fewer people in the severe group that had, you know, that had the vaccine than there were in the placebo group. Okay, so anyway, they don't think that there's any waning of protection, and the follow-up time was approximately 2 months after the second dose at this point in time. Good. So we know it lasts at least 2 months. So anyway, this is what the FDA did. They put all the data out. There's also a whole thing from the pharmaceutical company. I actually didn't read that one. That's on here. You can read that if you want. But it does seem like it's a start. And then the next question really is you know, getting the vaccine out there. Now, in the few minutes we have remaining here, there was an article a little bit about, you know, well, how effective is this going to be in our population? Okay, what are we doing here? So remember that when they talk about that they got, you know, however many, like a million doses, if you get a million doses, you know, or 50 million doses or whatever, you get 100 million doses, you know, divide that, first of all, take that number and divide it by two, because each person that gets the vaccine needs two doses, all right? That's the first thing to realize. So, you know, again, I told you that they talked about the number of vials. If you look at the British site, I think they said there's something like 970-some-odd vials in a package, you know, and then, again, those are kept in ultra-cold freezers, and in this particular case of this vaccine, and then diluted on-site, you know, you can give five shots with the first with each vial. Yeah, so however they distribute that out, that's, you can get through that. That's the logistic part of how, I don't know how quickly you can administer it to people, but that's kind of the way it goes. If you've ever dealt with like a injection or syringe, you know, you squirt a little saline in their bottle and you swirl it around until it dissolves, you draw it up and you give the injection. So switch needle to an in-person and then you do it again. So that's how we're going to do it. We do need to kind of half the doses that gives you the number of people that can get the vaccine for however much they sell it. So this particular vaccine, we're not going to get enough of this to do make a dent in our population of the United States. If you think about the population of the United States, Pfizer is not going to supply us enough drug this year, or, you know, to solve our problem. So this is a start, but we're going to need more vaccine from other people. So that was my first conclusion on this. Any comments on that real quick? So maybe that hadn't occurred to you when they said doses. Apparently there was a little controversial thing that we had a chance to buy more doses to Pfizer and we didn't do it. So that's a political thing. Okay, I don't know if that's true or not. All right, that's the problem. That I like science where people put it in a report. If they say it in a report and it, you know, and they admit to that, that's otherwise it just makes you mad, right? So I don't like to make you mad. I just like you to know that the fact is that right now everybody's going to complain because this is this great vaccine and then we can't get it, right? So there you go. So, but let's talk a little bit more about this growing number of people. And this is the problem I mentioned last week. If you vaccinate people when the virus is still growing at a huge rate, it doesn't work very much. One article I read today said it's like fighting a forest fire with a fire hose. You have a very good fire hose, but it's still a forest fire, right? So it really doesn't make it makes a big, much better effect if you can vaccinate a population that's on the flat part of the curve, right? Remember we were talking about flattening the curve? We did flatten the curve. And you know, what it took to flatten the curve wasn't very pleasant because we had to shut down things and all behave for a while. But if we could shut down things and not behave for a while, and I, you know, don't like doing this either, but the vaccine will work better. Does that make sense? Here's the logic behind that, okay? I gave you the vaccine, all right? The vaccine is really not, it starts to, after the first dose, we said it protects about, it's 50% effective efficacy, okay? So it'll protect you somewhat. And it won't start protecting you day one. It protects you about day 10 when you start making antibodies, okay? So you really need to wait around. So for right now, you still need to, you know, after you get that, you're going to have to keep the mask on, right? And then you're going to wait, and you're going to get another dose. And after the second dose, and then 10 days following that, that's when you're going to have your maximum protection level. And at that point in time, you know, we're pretty confident that you know, it looks like 95% of the people that reach that stage will be protected against getting severe COVID, or maybe prevent them from getting the virus in the first place. Remember, you could get a mild case after the vaccine as well. Okay. What we don't know, and they mentioned this in the study because they didn't do this. We don't know whether you could still infect others. We don't know whether we do know that you could probably still be infected during that time period. Okay, there are some, you know, numbers of people that will still get infected, but we don't even know whether you're still contagious if you're exposed, whether you carry it at all. You know, so that's one of the things. So again, the rest of the population that doesn't get the vaccine and the people that get the vaccine also need to wear the masks until we flatten the curve out. Because if we can keep the chances of encountering the virus, you know, in your day-to-day activities down, then, you know, it's more likely to be successful for you, right? So interestingly, in the first phase one trial stuff from Pfizer, where they had this group and they really included up to 85-year-old people in it, turns out the 55 to 85-year-old group actually did better in terms of fewer cases than reported, even in the placebo group than in the 18 to 50-year-old group, 18 to 55-year-old group. So, again, for you guys, I think that's important to remember that the older people are more careful, it seems like. They're really trying harder to avoid it, and that's definitely what I want you to do, and that's what I'm doing, is still trying to be careful to not, you know, infect yourself. The bulk of the people in the study that got it still were the younger people, actually, okay? So that's to be kept in mind, that people are still, if you're careful, you reduce your risk. And with that, I will mention the Swiss cheese model, which I read about this week, which is kind of interesting. Okay, so the Swiss cheese model, you may have seen that in the news. Interesting just way of thinking about it. It is... not scientific in a sense, but it was developed by scientists. And basically it's saying that everything that we do, you know, is like a piece of Swiss cheese, okay? Any behavior, any law, any rule, you can just throw it on another layer of Swiss cheese. And if you can imagine that the virus is starting out at one end of the Swiss cheese and trying to get its way through, you know, the first slice of Swiss cheese, the first doing only one thing is not going to do very much, okay? And that includes, you know, and they put the vaccine at the end and all the other behavior, like social distancing and things at the beginning. And anyway, so the other good thing I was reading about, I thought helpful to understand, is that, you know, you kind of choose your risk, right? And again, if you can minimize the risk by combining different strategies, you know, the hand washing, the social distancing, the mask wearing, the staying out of the closed places, you know, those things all by themselves help flatten the curve, right? We saw that already. Going out, spending time outside in the summertime, people got better, right? So without the vaccine. So now we add the vaccine to that. If we get better and then add the vaccine, then the vaccine is going to be a lot more effective. And they do say that even if the vaccine was a 50% effective one, it would do something. That's why that number was given to us there. So that would be the good thing, is, you know, maybe then people would be protected after the first shot, which again gives the virus a chance to, you know, misinfecting that group of people. So that's a good thing. Any comments or questions in the last few minutes here? We're out of time here for tonight. Okay, so it was double, but so let's just, whoever, I heard comment quickly, but no call sign, so let's all be patient. We'll get it. Who said comment quickly? Give me your call.
Kilo Juliet 7, India, Tango Zulu. Dot got it. Sorry, Brent, Brian. So, based on last year's census, we need 656 doses of this vaccination. And you said the best application would be in areas where there's a flat line of cases. So, who's going to buy that and who's going to distribute it based on that criteria?
Wait, no, it's a little confused. Okay, so I don't know where, could you say it again, what criterion you think they're using for this? The way I understand it right now is that they're going to distribute the vaccine. I'm not sure how the states are going to do it yet because they haven't told us that. Like in Great Britain, the first person they vaccinated was some random 90-year-old lady in a rest home. You know, so that's how they chose to do it, okay? The next guy was named William Shakespeare. I don't know why. Maybe they wanted to do it. He was 81, right? I'm not sure how they're going to get it out there. I'm just talking about the bulk, just the numbers available would go first, as I understand it. This is what's been proposed to the healthcare workers and the most vulnerable people, like these people that are old in nursing homes. So did you have another idea or heard something different about that?
No, I don't think I've heard anything about that. So who's buying the vaccine and who is deciding where that drops in? Is it at the federal level, the state level, the county level?
I think it's your tax dollars at work. Feds are saying that the vaccine will be purchased. It's already been purchased. It's free for everyone that gets it, okay? That's what they say. So it will be, if we're using the Pfizer vaccine, it's going to have to be given, you know, at a facility that has the ability to have these ultra-cold freezers. And, they haven't talked about how many doses each state will get. I'm just saying that the numbers of doses, I think they're talking is 100 million that we have signed up for, right? I'm telling you, each person needs two doses. So that's going to, we could say we give all that, right now. If we could get that up, that's how many that Pfizer has promised us, is that many doses. Now, we have another vaccine coming around the bend called Moderna's vaccine. They're going to promise us some other amount of vaccine, and we'll see what that is. I haven't read that one yet as to how much they've promised us. But with this vaccine, we get my understanding is 100 million doses. So 50 million people, starting first with frontline healthcare workers, rest home workers, and people in rest homes would be the first. Now, that was a committee decision that I heard about. So I don't know how it works in terms of which states get it or how that all works. We'll find that out.
Okay, very good. KJ7ITZ.
Yes, Richard, go ahead. Well, those numbers come from statistical modeling and making assumptions. And those, again, the assumptions that we make based on how infective the R value is. Of the virus. Now, I can't tell you why our value went from the highest in the country last week when I was talking to, down about the 20th or so, what changed in our criteria. But that's the hard part to pinpoint, okay, is what is how effective is it, how fast is it spreading, all right? But what we're saying is that the herd immunity, okay, so affects the number, the chances of people, what is the chance that you will encounter someone else that has an active case of the virus? That really is, So when you, when we talk about immunity, we're talking about if 70% of the people in a population are immune, then the chance of encountering someone in the remaining 30% it's not a big enough population for the virus to sustain itself. It won't grow. Okay, so what we're looking at is, does the virus, even if it gets into a population, does it spread? Does it cause an epidemic, right? That's the problem. Does it reproduce? Does it go above one and start going exponential like it's doing right now? Does that make sense?
Question K6STX.
Yeah, hi Dan. Yeah, Kilo 6 Sierra Tango X-ray. Go ahead.
Does Salem even have those super refrigerators to even hold this stuff?
I suspect they do, yeah. I don't know how many we have, but there are certain, definitely any research hospital, any place where they do medical research or biological research has these freezers. I had one in my lab when I was at UC San Diego. It was, you know, a necessary piece of equipment if you were going to do any kind of genetic studies. This is where you know, they're big chest freezers. They're about 6 to 8 feet long and, you know, 3 feet wide and, you know, 3 feet high. And I remember ours costing several $1,000s. And they're basically keep things at kind of dry ice temperature inside, like slightly colder than dry ice. And we also had the canisters of liquid nitrogen, which was the real stuff that really wanted to freeze something quickly. But that was a standard piece of equipment. And then we had a lot of freezers, regular freezers, to keep things in. And then we had refrigerators to keep them in. So I suspect that the big hospitals have them. I don't think your doctor's office has one. Maybe Kaiser, big Kaiser probably has them. Big facilities would have these freezers. But yeah, your small clinics, things like that, are not going to have them. Yep, go ahead, Richard. We're kind of running out of time. I can stop the net after your question, and then we can keep talking. It's fine. I just want to not be rude to people about the frequency.
That's a question. Is it really that cold when it goes into your arm? It's going to sound like it's going to have a froze arm.
God, no, it's not cold at all when it goes into your arm. So what they do, Dan, is they take the stuff. It's interesting. I've dealt with this kind of thing in personally. They you get these little vials, and they've got some little flaky white material at the bottom, which is basically dry. It's freeze dried inside these bottles, and then it looks like a standard injection bottle that I'm sure you've seen many times. It's a rubber top with a, you know, a little metal ring around it, and they pull off the top of the ring, and then you take a regular syringe and you put 1.9 milliliters of normal saline, which is comes out of another bottle, into there, and you swirl it around. So that's going to be room temperature, okay, when you get it. All right. Now, if you don't use that, if you make that up in advance, you would put it in the refrigerator. So if they were going to do a big bunch of people, they probably would have somebody up there squirting the 1.9 into there and swirling and putting them in the fridge and then keeping it pulling out a vial at a time. It says it's good for about 6 hours. So you wouldn't want to do that until you needed it. But the dry ice, as we know, would work. So getting it to someplace, we can put it in, you know, trucks and carry these freezers. But dry ice would be the simplest if we have enough dry ice. But yeah, by the time it gets in your arm, I hope they warm it up a little bit. Yeah, it's good to be at room temperature. KG7 GDB. Let's close the net, and then if there's any other questions, just, you know, again, this is just want to be fair to people about the network. There's lots of information here. Okay, so now it's 8:16 p.m. and that's late. So I'm sorry. This concludes our 529 Emergency Preparedness Net. There will be a recording available of today's discussion on the WA7AVU groups.io page. Richard's been recording. We meet each Tuesday evening at 7 p.m. on 145.29 megahertz. We thank Dan, WA7ABU, for the use of the repeater. Thank you to all who participated today and those who stood by to give us a clear channel. Kilo Golf 7, Golf Delta Bravo, closing the net now at state 16, and we now return the repeater to normal undirected amateur operations. KG7GDB, I'll be clear, but I'll stand by if there's any other discussion.